Good afternoon. Welcome to the State Affairs Committee, calling to order at 3.05 p.m. Tuesday, February 21st in the Max Grunberg Room, Alaska Capitol. That was, I think, all that cello practice from growing up really got some wrist muscles. Would the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Cup?
Here.
Representative Josephson? Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Cup? Representative Ledoux?
Here.
Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Chair Christ Tompkins?
Here. And with seven members present, we have a quorum and full attendance today. A reminder on alternates, Representative Kopp and Representative Josephson, both alternates are obviously not present. And for any members who foresee absences of significance that are foreseeable, please confer with me and we can make sure we sort of swap in alternates as needed in future meetings. Thank you to Martha and also to Kyle for keeping things running today. Much appreciated. Silent cell phones per usual, and we have three items on today's agenda. House Bill 91 relating to APOC registration fees. This is the second hearing for that bill, and then sort of a twofer, or married legislation, if you will, HCR 1 and HB 44, both relating to legislative ethics and conflict of interest. And I misspoke for HB 91. I guess it's the third hearing, if I'm learning to count barely here. And there's a CS forthcoming on HB 91, but given previous committee testimony, the sponsor's been doing some thinking and some working, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to at least sort of provide an update for the committee and continue that dialogue so we can sort of maintain momentum on this piece of legislation. And in that spirit, I wanted to invite the sponsor, Representative Keto, and staff, Ms. Crystal Kinneman, to the table to perhaps share some of the thinking on the legislation as well as exchange in questions and answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Sam Keto, Representative, House District 33, Northern Southeast Alaska, including Bower Capital City, Juneau. And based on questions and some comments we've received from this committee as well as from people on email engaged in the process, we have started looking a little bit differently at the idea of the tax and looking at the possibility of really maybe that just needs to be a fee. It provides a much more direct path to satisfy the program receipt question that we originally started with. It ended up as a tax really because of my interest in identifying a percentage that seemed to be better suited for a tax methodology, but we are exploring some different ways of looking at it, and Ms. Kinneman can provide some of those details, but the idea is to generate about the same amount of money, but make sure that that money does go directly to the Alaska Public Offices Commission so that they can utilize that money to support their operations, satisfy their program receipt authority, and then it actually will provide some additional savings to the state of Alaska. So with that on the details, I'll turn it over to Ms. Kinneman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Kinneman, staff to Representative Keto. As he mentioned, we were looking at a different way to establish the fees to generate the amount of revenue that we had originally anticipated. And so the idea that we came up with was a stair-step idea, understanding that the lower the contract amount, the less work there is for the filings with APOC, and the higher the contracts as you go up, the more work that's associated with them. So what we are proposing is a fee of $350 for those contracts that are under $30,000, for contracts between $30,000 and $59,999, a $650 fee. And for contracts over $60,000, a fee of $850. This would result in a dollar amount of $259,150 based on the 2015 and 16 numbers that were provided by APOC. If you couple these candidate fees with the amount estimated by APOC that's in their fiscal note for the campaign, for the elections and other legislative financial disclosure filing fees, the amount would be $365,750, which is much closer to the amount that Representative Keto and I had discussed in what was provided in the sponsor statement. So that gets us much closer to that. As a result, with the FY 18 budget request, from our calculations, it would result in a $120,000 approximate savings to undesignated general fund, because that amount would be replaced by the designated general fund that's general fund fees that were established by this stair step.
Thank you, Ms. Kinnaman. And is there notice the committee? Ms. Heather Hebden is online, also executive director of APOC or APOC, as I've noticed they say. Are there questions from the committee on this new direction? Representative Ledoux.
So I'm just trying to figure out why a smaller contract might necessarily be less complicated than a larger contract. I know when I practiced law, sometimes you take, you know, a smaller case and you think, oh, this is not going to be any big deal. And it turned into a terrifically big deal. And then you'd have what looked like a larger monetary case and you thought, oh, this is going to be really complex and it would settle, you know, after a couple of letters. So I guess I want to get from anybody who can answer the question an idea of what sorts of things APOC would do with a contract that was below $30,000 and what sorts of things they would do, how they would do things differently with a contract which is above $60,000.
Through the chair, this is Representative Keto for the record again. As we look at this, I think there are two different ways to consider the question. One really is the work that a lobbyist is providing to the client. And I would agree that sometimes a client that comes in and says, we'll pay you $5,000 to do some work, that work ends up being a lot more than anticipated. And perhaps conversely, maybe a client pays $60,000 and has an idea of a lot of things that need to be done, and maybe those things don't need to be done. The idea from the perspective of our office and looking at the Alaska Public Offices Commission is that if you've got a client that has a fee paying $10,000 perhaps, the likelihood of that client requiring a lot of lobbyists taking individuals out to dinner or billing for food or other things that end up in a report that would need to be reconciled or resolved is potentially and possibly, at least from my experience, a lot less when you've got a client that's not paying as much money than it is with somebody. Maybe they've got a client paying $60,000 and part of that is to take various people out to dinners, and those things have to be reported independently with APOC, and then those reports have to be reconciled with the activities of the client, because if the client has lobbying presence or payments, those payments then have to be reconciled against the activities of the lobbyist.
Just to follow up on that?
Follow up, Representative Ledoux.
So, I mean, if that's the sort of thing that we're looking at, I've kind of noticed that it looks like from various lobbyist statements that they never take anybody out to dinner. But they are taking people out to dinner, but the client is picking up the tab. It's not being billed to the client. It's the client is actually there and picks up the tab. And so that doesn't go into any APOC report. And so then other people might entertain at their homes, which doesn't go into any APOC report. So I guess I'm just, I'd like to hear from Miss Hebden. I call her Heather, so so I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the last name right, as to her thoughts about what sort of things that she would be looking at with a higher-priced client.
And Ms. Hebden, could you put yourself on the record and state your affiliation before addressing Representative Ledoux's question?
Yes. Heather Hebden, Executive Director with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it is my understanding, and I've not had a whole lot of interaction on the lobbying side as far as their auditing procedures, but it was my understanding that this was put forth under this stair-step approach simply based on the volume of reports coming in, kind of tied to the money that is being spent on these contracts, foreseeably the larger contracts would require more reporting. And that's only because these fees are not necessarily based on a single registration fee tied to a single lobbyist who may have a dozen different clients. So that was my understanding, was that foreseeably the lobbyists that are making more money have more clients, therefore they require more reporting.
Follow-up, Representative Ledoux?
I'm confused now. So the lobbyists that had more clients would require more reporting from each individual client, or they'd require more. Is a lobbyist with one client, where that client is paying him or her 60 grand or 61,000, is that lobbyist likely to have less reports than the lobbyist with one client whose client is paying that lobbyist $10,000? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
The Chair, Representative Ledoux, no, I don't think that is my understanding of it. But when we are looking at these numbers, these totals, and the way they've broken it out into these three specific dollar amounts, it's not necessarily based on the individual lobbyist, but rather the amount that the lobbyist is making from lobbying activities. So therefore, if a single lobbyist had one client that was paying him $60,000, that's one thing, but I don't think that this is what it necessarily anticipates. What it anticipates is the one lobbyist who may have 10 clients and therefore earns $60,000. Therefore, he owes separate reports for those 10 clients. Does that better respond to your concerns?
Well, I understand the question that you're answering, but I'm actually not sure that is what the representative had in mind. I think that what the representative had in mind was a bill in which every lobbyist would pay a registration fee, and if the fee for any given client was 60,000 or more than 60,000, that would be $800 or $850. And it was 10,000 or less, it would be $350. I don't think he was doing it on the entire book of clients that the lobbyists have. Am I correct, or am I missing something here?
Through the chair again, this is Representative Keto, Representative Ledoux. The way that the fees are currently assessed are $250 on each client for each lobbyist. So if a lobbyist has multiple clients, they're paying that fee for each client. If a client has multiple lobbyists, each lobbyist is paying for them as a client. The goal of trying to restructure the payments for, or the fees for the APOC collections was to try and meet a target of generating revenue that would be able to be utilized by the Alaska Public Offices Commission to fulfill their duties so that they would not be subject to budget reductions that would decrease the service to the point where we're not getting reports out to the public in a timely fashion.
Just a
follow-up.
And, no, I understand that. And, by the way, I'm not necessarily opposed to the way that this is being done. I mean, if somebody has a client that's paying $60,000, that person can probably, or that client can probably more afford to pay the $850 than the client who's paying $10,000. But I'm just not necessarily sure that the $60,000 client necessarily engenders more for any particular lobbyist than does the $10,000 client, but I don't know.
And one thought, Representative Ledoux, it seems like there may be a parallel between this piece of legislation and a committee I know we were both on in terms of the Court System Finance Subcommittee and assessing court fees based on the size of the tort claim at stake, even though something that a tort claim smaller than $100,000 may inquire more legal work and court services than something larger. We just sort of use that as a blunt metric for involvement, but throwing that out there. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the sponsors looking at something other than income tax for funding this. I think it's probably going to be easier to manage. One question I did have, as long as Ms. Hebden is on the phone, is we have a $50 per public official financial disclosure, legislative disclosure, which I think is new, because if I recall right, I just filed a POFD, and I don't think I had to send a check in with it. But if you do $50 times about 1,200, you get to 60,000. So there's only 60 of us in the legislature. So are there 1,100 other people that are going to be taxed with a $50 charge? I assume is that the intent? Because it sounds like it's going to be a lot more than just the legislature here that's going to be tagged with a $50 to basically submit an annual financial disclosure form. And I don't know if Ms. Hebden or the sponsor would like to address that.
Ms. Hebden, are you able to speak to that question?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, it might be better addressed through the sponsor, as this is still some of our questions about who exactly would be subject to this registration fee. The POFD statute does capture a significant amount of filers, and I believe when I looked at it over a five-year average, we received roughly 1,300 POFDs in a year. But that does capture several different groups of people above and beyond state filers, to include like the executive branch and boards and commissions, as well as the legislative financial disclosure and the governor's office. That would also capture the numbers that I took were from our electronic filing system, so it would have captured a lot of municipal filers and communities with populations more than 15,000 who are subject to our electronic reporting requirements. So one of our concerns is that provision be a little bit more fleshed out so that we do know our target area that we're hoping to collect fees from.
Okay, if I might, by way of follow-up, how much effort is involved? You've got that kind of set up to where it's all electronic now. As I recall, you fill it out, you push a button, and it's uploaded. How much effort, energy, and staff work is required on your end of it, if you will, to manage that?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, the majority of APOC's budget is personnel. The online filing system, it's itself requires a full-time analyst programmer to maintain the system. But what we find that takes most of our time is direct service to the public, so answering phone calls, answering emails, assisting filers with the system, as well as auditing reports. Currently, under the statutes, we are required to audit every single report that comes into the office. We just don't have the staff to do that.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the first bill was basically, I'll call it an income tax because it was a percentage of the value of the income that the lobbyists made. And right now it's $250 per contract. So this is sort of a sliding scale, basically. So not quite an income tax, but it's progressive in that the higher the value of the contract, the higher the fee. So it's kind of a percentage. Sort of. I don't know if that's a question.
Representative Wolf, through the chair, it is a sliding scale based on the income of the client.
Follow up.
But it's per contract, whereas previously the 2.5 was based on gross of the lobbyist's total contracts, correct?
Again, this is Representative Quito. For the record, through the chair, Representative Wool, the mechanism for applying the tax versus fee is exactly the same. So the 2.5% would have applied to each lobbyist contract for each lobbyist. This is a change from the tax to a fee. The fee set at a sliding scale, not a percentage, because for all of those below 30,000, it's one fee. For all those between 30 and 60, it's another fee. For above 60, it's another fee.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Heather's still with us on the line, this question is for her. Heather, Gary Knopf, and just for the record, I was one of the many callers that you were servicing during this campaign season, and I thank you for that because you kept me out of trouble. So thank you. But I want to, what I need to ask you about, Heather, so I was going through the sponsor statement on the bill, and he references where you were at $1.3 million in FY15 and you fell to $866 million in, and I'm trying to understand the budget process here, really. And so in, and you fell to $866 million in FY16, and I'm looking at your permanent full-time positions, 12, 12, 12, up through FY17 authorized, and then the 17 management plan drops you to 10, governor's plan drops you to 8, and your organizational chart currently shows you have 8 positions. So is that what you're currently running, is 8 positions, Heather? Is that what you've been at, or...?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, currently we have 8 PCNs of that. We don't have our analyst programmer position filled, and we currently have another position that is vacant.
So that's the 2 vacant positions that are shown in the 17 management plan. So have them been vacant a while then, or have you been operating with just 8 for quite some time, or...?
The chair, Representative Knopf, that is correct. In fact, well, when our previous director left, that opened up another position that used to be occupied by myself. We have yet to recruit for that yet.
Okay. So I guess I'm trying to ask, and I may have to go to the sponsor. Now, as I mentioned, I was trying to understand the budget process, and I don't care who picks up this question. Through the chair, if I may follow.
Please.
I think the sponsor had we talked a little bit before about expenditure authorization, but not the authority to collect that expenditure. Do I have that right, Mr. Quito? Is that
through the chair, Representative Knopf? That is correct. So the legislature had authorized receipt authority up to $240,000, but the only statutory fee that could be collected was the $250 per client per lobbyist, which raised about $106,000.
So follow up with so Mr. Quito, when I'm looking at the component details of the budget, so the numbers I see are not actually allocated appropriated dollars. Is that correct? I mean, not $2. I mean, they're authorized, but not necessarily department numbers. Is that how I read that? How would we know what the true numbers are that they're operating with?
Through the chair, I'm going to have to either defer to Ms. Hebden or perhaps Ms. Kieneman has a better answer to that.
Okay, thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, this is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Rep. Keto. In FY16 actuals, that's probably the best number that we can look at through this. Okay. The legislature had appropriated $758,500 in UGF. Mm-hmm. You can see down there in their designated general fund category, there was 107.5, because that was the only receipt authority that they could pull in. You can see in the if you go over one more column, and for the rest of the members of the committee, I will ensure that you get this document as well. For the FY16 final, there was 240 that was appropriated by the legislature, but that was hollow authority since they didn't have the fees, the revenue generated by those fees to collect. So the legislature thought we were giving them additional money, and so they wouldn't suffer quite as big of a cut. However, in the end, their actual fees were substantially lower than what was authorized.
So follow up. So it's fair to say then that what we thought we were appropriating, we did not, and the administration felt, yeah, you can spend it if you can collect it, and that didn't happen. Is that, in a nutshell, what we're saying?
Representative Knopf, through the chair, basically, yes.
Okay. So, and I can see over the years where unrestricted general funds has not necessarily climbed. So it's a little deceiving, I'll be honest with you, when you look at the numbers. So I'll just ask you then, so when we get up and do the 17 management plan, we're showing $242,000 in designated general funds, but that's only if this passes, is that correct? I mean, they still don't have authority to collect them. Do I understand that correctly?
Representative Knopf, through the chair, they would not be able to generate that 242.6. They would just be able to generate right about that 107. Depending on the number of filers.
Now it's starting to make sense.
Which is
a little bit.
Which is the intent behind this, is to generate additional fee authority for them to collect.
Okay. Further questions, Representative?
No, just one quick comment.
Yeah, please.
So, in that, I understand there's a committee substitute coming forward. I'm also going to work on some stuff, and I'm hoping to run it by your office and you. Maybe we can work this together. But I do want to mention, Mr. Chair, if I may, that one of the things I've never been particularly fond of, and now that we're looking at imposing fees, is the mandate of boards and commissions. Boards are appointments, not necessarily compensated. There's about 360 people in that boards and commission. So I'm going to try to see if it makes sense to try and exempt them out of that APOC filing. And the intent is to alleviate some of that workload. And I guess we'll have that discussion as it comes forward. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. And this might interrelate to this piece of legislation, but I know for the DOA Finance Subcommittee, one of the recommendations to full finance was looking at some of these APOC questions, including possibly reducing the number of public officials, including school board members or municipal officials who might have to file POFDs. So there might be different pieces, moving in the same direction. Any other questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much, Representative Keto and Ms. Kieneman, for the update. Let us know when the CS comes in, and Representative Knopf will be in touch, it sounds. And any other committee members, please be in touch with the sponsor. And that takes us to the next piece of legislation on the agenda, and I think we'll take a brief at ease because I think there's a PowerPoint to sort of lay out some of the components of this bill. So while we get that set up, we'll go off the record for a few minutes. Going back on the record, second item on the agenda today, and really second and third items on the agenda, HCR 1 and HB 44 relating to legislative ethics and conflicts of interest. We heard only HB 44 last Saturday as a brief introduction and not HCR 1, which is an oversight, although not terribly consequential. So just to sort of make things uniform, ask Representative Gren, the sponsor, and or Ryan Johnson to present briefly on HCR 1 and then perhaps proceed with the PowerPoint that your office has prepared to overview the components of these two pieces of legislation.
So thank you, Chairman. For the record, Representative Jason Gren, proudly representing District 22 in Anchorage, Alaska.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Jason Gren. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you again for allowing me the opportunity to testify on HB 44 and House Concurrent Resolution 1. I will begin with a sectional analysis of HCR 1 quickly. It only has one section. Section 1 amends the rule to state that a legislator may abstain from a vote with a majority consent. Currently, Uniform Rule 34B states that a legislator may abstain from a vote by unanimous consent. It also amends the uniform rule to include two instances when a member may not vote. A legislator may not vote on their own abstention, and a legislator may not vote on an issue if the body casts a majority vote for the legislator to abstain. So that concludes HCR 1.
A question on HCR 1 before we get the PowerPoint. Yeah, Representative.
Here's a definition, please. You said a legislator may not vote on his own abstention. What is that? I'm not. Can you define what that means exactly?
Through the chair, Representative Wool. So, after a legislator makes the motion to abstain, we thought it proper that that legislator not vote on their own abstention.
Oh, so, I see. I got you.
I now draw the committee's members' attention to the PowerPoint. I will be running through the current statutes and where the language for HB 44 and HCR 1 were drawn from. So here's the language for the current Uniform Rule 34B, which you can see highlighted in blue, the need for a unanimous consent to allow for a legislator to abstain. These are the changes proposed by HCR 1, again highlighted in blue, a change from a unanimous consent to a majority consent by the body. So the source for the language for a majority vote actually comes from Alaska statute. It is already existing in AS 2920010A, which is where the state dictated that municipalities must have a conflict of interest ordinance. And so you see the requirements listed, and under AS 2920010A, Section 3, ruling of the presiding officer can be overridden by a majority vote of the body. And since the majority vote is used on the municipal level to overturn an abstention, we thought it a pre-existing benchmark to allow for an abstention in the legislature. So HCR 1 seeks to bring about consistency between what the state requires of a municipality and what is required of the legislature itself.
And Mr. Johnson, there's a question, although I wonder if it might make sense to get through a few slides and maybe we can sort of clump a bunch of questions together at the same time. And perhaps you can sort of flag when you've gone through the first tranche of slides that you think gives a good overview.
As well as coming from existing Alaska statute, this slide is the legislative breakdown for voting recusals for states across country. And this breakdown is done by individual houses in each state, not by the state itself, because each state has a Senate and a House besides Nebraska, which is a unicameral system. So in some states, the two legislative bodies share rules, while in other states, one rule is used for one body and another rule is used for another. So 30 bodies use a method of voting to allow for a legislator to abstain. 24 of those use a majority consent, 4 use a two-thirds consent, and Alaska is the lone state that requires unanimous consent. And then 57 bodies use a method of legislator declaring a conflict and then being required to abstain. There is no vote. Five bodies use the method of declaring a conflict and then the legislator is required to vote, or they have the choice to abstain. And there are eight bodies that use a method of allowing for a presiding officer to use their discretion. In this method, the presiding officer determines if the conflict is substantial or not. If the conflict is substantial, then the presiding officer grants the legislator the abstention. And if the conflict is not substantial, then the legislator is required to vote by the presiding officer.
All right, I think we have a critical mass of questions, if that works okay, by the sponsor. Representative Johnston, I think you were first in the queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I just had a question on your slide a couple pieces slides back on the source of language for the majority vote. In that statute, does it show when that was created? Was that like in the original? So I would kind of assume that's in the original first run of the statutes. And
so it was through the chair, Representative Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Grin. Through the chair, Representative Johnston. In the original statute, it was from June 30th, 1986.
And
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And where is on the statute where it talks about the legislature? When is that from? I guess I'm through the chair. I'm just trying to get a sense of when, if these were done around the same time or if they were put in place at different times.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I don't know an exact date for the uniform rule when it was brought about for unanimous consent, but I'll look into it and get you an exact date.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnston. And Representative Tuck, I believe you had a question as well.
Just on the following slide, or maybe the following two slides, it just looked like you were reading off different numbers than what we're looking at. I just was curious if yours is up more up to date or if the slide is up more up to date.
Oh, yeah. The slide numbers are correct. My script is not. I apologize.
Those are the current numbers.
Yeah, the slide numbers are the current numbers. Yes, sir.
And Representative Ledoux.
So I didn't realize this. So, and I walked in just a little bit late, so maybe I missed something. But so it's state law that requires the municipalities to have a conflict of interest statute, but we don't bother to do it ourselves?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, Representative Jason Grin. That is correct.
I think we call that a softball question. Yeah, okay. Further question, Representative Ledoux. Okay, Ms. Johnson, please. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'd also say they have an Open Meetings Act at a municipal level that we don't have at the legislature too. So maybe we'll want to take that one on next.
Well, this would be the committee for that, Representative Johnson. We can just get in the spirit, Mr. Johnson and Representative Gunn. Please continue with the presentation.
Ryan Johnston, staff Representative Grin. Now moving on to HB 44, as we talked about in the last meeting, HB 44 focuses on changes in AS 2460-030, specifically in the sections E and G. So currently, AS 2460-030E deals with a potential conflict of interest from taking official action that would substantially benefit or harm a person the legislator is negotiating employment. And that's the only stipulation in that section is negotiating for employment. HB 44 changes Section E to broaden the scope from the previous definition of only negotiating for employment to now include the legislator's immediate family members, the legislator and immediate family member's employer, and to still include the negotiating for employment situation, and also adding in a previous employer that the legislator worked for within the preceding 12-month period. Currently, there are 29 states that have statutes that deal directly with possible conflicts of interest that could all arise from a legislator being employed outside of the legislature. One question that we've had come up before is the monetary amount of $10,000. So the inclusion of the $10,000 threshold for an employer comes from AS 2460 990B, which determines the standard for a substantial interest in a legislative action by a member of the public who seeks or has contracts in excess of $10,000 annually for goods or services with the legislature or agency of the state. This threshold brings the legislature up to the same standard in which the state holds a person of the public when determining a substantial interest, thus creating a continuity between the public and the legislature. This was done looking at what is required by the state from others and how the legislature can be consistent with those requirements. The state of Virginia also uses the exact $10,000 threshold for an employer. It can be found in VS 30-101. So moving on to AS 2460-030G, this is the section that you see the use of substantial class, and is again consistent with our current statutes, directly pulled out of AS 2460-030, Section G, highlighted in blue. And also, again, it's found in AS 2460-990B. So the substantial class of persons language is consistent with our previous and other states' legislature or statutes as well, and this gives you a breakdown by state. Those that have the substantial class language, there's 19 states. There's also 8 states that use similar language to the substantial class, except they deal in the terms of general public. Instead of the substantial class and the effect on that class, it's the effect on the interest of the general public of the state. And lastly, there's 2 states that use both forms of language in their conflict of interest determination.
And Mr. Johnson, I believe we have some committee questions. Representative Tuck, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just trying to follow what the blue language is. The blue language is existing language that you're highlighting. It's not proposed changes.
It's through the chair, Representative Tuck, it's our current statutes. Yes.
Okay. And the blue you're highlighting so that you can point out how many states have that. Is that the purpose?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, firstly, when you say it's our current statute, you mean it's a proposed bill that's currently in law?
So this right here is, through the chair, Representative Wall, this is our current AS 2460-030G. So it's our existing statute as of now, and we're proposing amendments to it.
Follow up?
Yeah, so by this statute, a legislator may not vote on a question of equity ownership in a business in that effect. So let's say I own a chicken farm, and I'm voting on laws about importing chickens or something like that, and I'm in that class, then am I allowed to vote on that? It says may not vote.
And again, it's through the chair, Representative Wool. Again, unless required by uniform rules, where from the uniform rule, you get the unanimous objection. Thus, this allows you to vote from the single objection. But to your question about the chicken farm, if a bill came up that dealt directly with the size of your farm, let's say you had a farm 500 acres, and there was tax incentives for only chicken farms that were 500 acres. We would say that under current statute, you would have a conflict of interest. If a bill came up that gave tax incentives to every chicken farm in the state of Alaska, we would say that, no, there is no substantial benefit or harm because the industry is being affected as a whole.
Follow-up?
Yeah, I guess I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair, follow-up. I guess that's where I get the delineation of 500 acres or not 500 acres, or, I mean, if you're in an industry and you're voting on a bill that affects an industry, it certainly affects you. And then to delineate if it's the whole class of people in that industry, or more, or if it's a subset of that class based on size or whatever, I guess those are sort of pretty technical questions that may not be able to be discernible in the momentary moment of a House floor vote, and then I could take it to ethics and go through an ethics thing, and, you know, 3 months later I might get a decision. So when I see classes and subsets, and it's where it gets a little confusing. Also, if I was an employee of that said industry, then I wouldn't be affected because I'm not an owner. So, for example, if I work for an oil company, I'm voting on oil taxes, that's different than if I own the oil company and I'm voting on oil taxes. Correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, under current statute, yes, that would be the correct interpretation.
Follow up. So, but then you're also saying if I own the oil company, I'm voting on oil taxes, that if it affects all oil companies, then that's okay too. So it wouldn't change. I could still vote on all that stuff.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, correct. That is correct.
And for Representative Ledoux and myself, this is a little bit of deja vu. We're in Judiciary, which was the first committee referral. And
sorry.
Nothing to your questions. I think the point being, this is a realization for me that a lot of the disclosures of conflict of interest on the House floor right now are actually not required by the letter of the law as the law is written right now, because the law is much tighter about what conflicts actually are. I was also going to note that Jerry Anderson with the administrator for the Select Committee on Ethics is online, and maybe to the question that you were getting at, Representative Wool, Mr. Anderson, would you be able to speak to what constitutes a substantial class, similar to what Representative Wool was asking?
This is Jerry Anderson. I'm the administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, for the record. And to the question by Representative Wool, that has been the subject of a number of advisory opinions, the exact question that you've asked. And as Representative Wool has stated, it is very complex, and those opinions can't be answered except with a specific set of facts.
I'm seeing lots of hands go up. For Mr. Anderson, maybe we can just continue with him on the line. Representative Ledoux, did you have a question?
I don't have a question for Mr. Anderson. I do have a comment to make, however.
Sure. Well, Representative Tuck and Representative Knopp, any questions for Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it would be nice, Mr. Anderson, that if we can get the last three cases to where there was a conflict of interest on the floor, because this is a really gray area. And I think it's always safer to declare a conflict than it is not to declare a conflict. But I know there has been within the last 5 years at least one case to where, and if we can blank out the names or this and that, you know, but just look at the case by facts so we can better understand where the conflict lies by looking at some examples.
Mr. Anderson, would it be possible to provide that to the committee?
Yes. I could provide that just as a matter of clarification. We have both complaint decisions and advisory opinions on this specific issue that I could provide to the committee.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, I was looking more towards the complaint, but the advisors would be nice also, but I was looking more for the complaint.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Tuck and Mr. Anderson for providing that information. And Representative Knopf, a question for Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, I really think that this muddies the waters, I'll be honest with you. So if we try to work all the scenarios in our mind, so I'm going to give you a scenario, and if you can just give me your 30-second opinion if it's a conflict or gray area. So we currently have an omnibus workman's comp reform bill in front of us, and probably an unforeseen consequence of that, maybe not unforeseen, but there's a large benefit to our collective bargaining units if that thing should pass. So if a member of our body is a member of a collective bargaining unit, would he have a conflict voting on that particular bill?
through the chair, Representative Knopp, what you have described is a very large class of people, and those particular individuals, if someone who is potentially voting on that, the member of that large class, they would not substantially benefit greater than the class under the current statute.
Follow-up, okay. Representative Knopp?
Thank you.
And Representative Ledoux, well, maybe, sorry to keep punting you off, but any other questions for Mr. Anderson, Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question, Mr. Anderson. Hypothetical, of course. Let's suppose there's a vote on the floor. Someone declares a conflict of interest. There's a vote on that. The person feels the vote didn't go one way or the other. And anyhow, they dispute it. It goes to ethics. Is that a timely resolution, or is that a long investigation? Is that going to take a week, a day, a week, and a month? I mean, is it going to be the next session? Are we going to revisit the vote? Are we going to redo it all? What happens at that point?
Through the chair, I'm unable to provide anything beyond the current statutes, and I think the process you're describing is a process that would be part of the potential legislation that you're looking at now, and so I could offer an opinion on that. Obviously, under the current rules, it's much different because a conflict of interest is declared. If there's an objection, that person would be required to vote.
Well, I think we'll go on pause for Mr. Anderson right now and offer the opportunity for Representative Ledoux to make her a comment.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think the statute as currently written, even if you were to amend the uniform rules so that somebody would actually have to vote, there'd probably be very few cases where that person would have to vote under this, under the current version of this statute, and that basically the conflict of interest statute has, you know, a hole big enough that you could drive a tank through.
And running with that metaphor, just to figure out how big or small this hole is. Mr. Anderson, you responded to the negative to Representative Knopf's hypothetical that what Representative Knopf described would not constitute a conflict of interest. Could you, realize we're putting you on the spot, describe a hypothetical that would constitute a conflict of interest under current law?
The chair, again, Jerry Anderson as the administrator for the Ethics Committee, a potential one could be where you have a financial stake in the vote, for example, in the same situation, collective bargaining, and perhaps your compensation was tied to the outcome of that you had bonuses or other incentives with that. That would mean that you would have a greater impact on you than that large class of collective bargaining people.
Representative Ledoux has a hand up. Representative Ledoux.
Well, I actually don't understand why that would be the case, because under a collective bargaining, there's a big class of people. So why would just one person? I mean, under this, the wording of this statute, it has to be different than a large class of people. So why would the collective bargaining situation be different than anything else?
To the chair, I believe that was a question directed to me.
Yes.
Of a follow-up to Representative Ledoux. The scenario that I was describing was where the financial impact would be greater on that person that was going to be voting on that piece of legislation than on the collective class that they belong to, which was a collective bargaining unit.
Follow up?
Yeah, would that ever happen in reality? I mean, wouldn't it affect everybody in the collective bargaining unit?
And maybe I can step in here, Mr. Anderson, just to clarify the question. Is the hypothetical that you're describing, Mr. Anderson, that the person who might have a conflict might be a negotiator for the collective bargaining unit and have some kind of bonus or incentive structure, and because that person was a negotiator for the collective bargaining unit, that unique status would constitute the conflict? Does that question make sense?
Yes, I think that's what I'm trying to describe, is a situation where you may be part of that collective bargaining unit, but because of your status with it and negotiator, as you've described, you would have a greater financial benefit that could arise to you as a result of the legislation that's being looked at.
You'd sort of like maybe get a bonus or something for negotiating a good contract? I mean, is that what we're talking about? Because this seems, I guess it seems relatively far-fetched.
I think that's a question for you, Mr. Anderson, if you're able to field it.
Through the chair, Representative Dew, that is the situation that I'm describing. It may be far-fetched, but I believe that that would be required when you're dealing with a large class of people, is that the benefit to you is greater than the benefit on that large class of people.
And Mr. Anderson, if I can circle back to one other hypothetical, because this seems pretty foundational to understanding this bill or the law as it exists right now, running with Representative Wool's chicken farmer and the 500 acres of chicken farms, if you had a chicken farm piece of legislation, that would not constitute a conflict of interest to the chicken farmer legislator. But if you had chicken farm legislation that related to chicken farms 500 acres or greater, that would constitute a conflict of interest. Do I understand that correctly?
To the chair, my understanding of that question would be, in part, the answer to that would be, in part, if you were the only chicken farmer that had 500 acres or more, you're obviously benefiting if there's provisions in legislation that required it to be 500 acres or more to get the benefits from that legislation. Obviously, you'd be benefiting more than the class of chicken farmers.
Representative Wool has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you opened the chicken farmer gate there. But so, hate to do this, but so you have chicken farmers as a class. Then you have, I don't know how we got into this example. Then you got chicken farmers, chicken farmers, a subclass of 500 acre plus, 500 acres or more chicken farms. That's a subclass. Let's say there's more than one. Let's say there's 1,000 chicken farmers, but there's 50 that have a farm of 50 or more, 500 more acres. So, I mean, at what point is it a class? What point is it too small to be a class? What if there was five? I mean, I hate to be splitting hairs, and these are probably decisions that have to be made on a case-by-case basis. But, you know, I look at, say, oil companies again, and some produce 30,000 barrels a day, and some produce 100,000 barrels a day, and, you know, there's certain delineations made on production or production of eggs, as the case may be. So, you know, if there's class and subclass, I mean, at what point is it benefiting too small of a class to be a class? And again, maybe it's just rhetorical question, but, you know, if it's more than one, or if it's five or ten, is that still a class?
Mr. Anderson?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I believe that those are the grappling questions, type of grappling questions, that the Ethics Committee struggles with when provided a request for advisory opinion.
Thank you. That's what I figured.
Representative Knopp.
Mr. Anderson, thanks for all you're doing there. I know we're asking you some questions here for sure. So it seems like in all the scenarios we're talking about, your response always falls back to the financial benefit. But I would probably argue there's a lot of conflicts of interest that we could support on the floor as legislators that are not financially connected. Is that not fair to say? And so, I mean, are we going to make all of the determinations and conflicts of interest around the financial results of that decision? Is that what's driving our legislation? Was that clear as mud, Mr. Anderson?
Well, again, through the chair, Representative Knopp, I believe that I can speak to how the current law addresses that, and it does speak to substantial benefit or harm, and typically those are in financial terms, but I believe that it could be non-quantifiable benefits or harms that could still be a conflict of interest basis.
Okay. All right. That's good. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Appreciate your time.
Representative Ledoux.
So I'll give you a scenario. So suppose a legislator has a family member who is a lobbyist and is voting on a bill that is significant to that lobbyist family member. Would that be a conflict of interest?
I think
it's, this is to Mr. Anderson.
For Mr. Anderson.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think I would need more facts, just as the committee would look at more facts just than those bare facts to determine a conflict of interest in terms of, you know, again, what is the class of lobbyists that are being affected by that potential legislation, and is that harm any greater with that family member? I think are some of the issues that they would be looking at.
Well, I mean, I think, too, a member of the general public, when you're talking about a conflict of interest, I would say that most people would think that if there is such a thing as a conflict of interest, that's a conflict of interest. So if this statute, the way we have it now, doesn't even definitely consider my hypothetical as a conflict of interest, it's got some big problems.
Tink-sized problems. Okay, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves because this is we're trying to figure out when to declare, but I think the bill addresses mostly after you declare. And so what we have, well, except for I think currently, when we're in committee, you don't have to declare a conflict of interest. You do have to declare a conflict of interest when you're on the floor taking the final vote. But it looks like they do add a section in here where you do have to declare a conflict while in committee, as well as make that declaration on the floor. And then on the floor is when we decide whether or not that person shall or shall not vote. But I did ask for some examples, real examples, which might help clarify things. But I think I don't know if we're changing the definition of when you declare or how you declare or what you declare over, although we do have some language changes for substantial benefit or harm. We are making exceptions to the operating budget, and we are defining financial interests rather than having in there equity ownership. So, but I think that the process is really that once you declare, what happens next? It's mostly the bill.
Point well taken, Representative Tuck, and maybe we can use that as a segue to proceed with the presentation, but as soon as you get through a few more slides, I think we have questions.
For the sake of time, Mr. Chair, we have 11 more slides, and I know you have another committee hearing at 4:30, so what would you like us to do at this point? We can continue, or...
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Yeah, I think we may collectively have a finance subcommittee at 4:30, if I'm remembering correctly. And we do have a 5:30 meeting. I guess it would be my hope we could get through the presentation through whatever period of time this evening and maybe knock out a few more slides right now and get as close as possible to liberate ourselves as much as possible this evening.
So the proposed changes in HB 44 to AS 2460-030G include a legislator shall declare a conflict of interest before voting on a question before a committee of the legislature, which is currently not in statute. HB 44 adds the legislator's immediate family member as a beneficiary of a potential conflict of interest, and immediate family is defined in AS 2460-990 Section 6, and it's there currently for you as well. So other states that reference family members or immediate family members, there are 28 states that include language for the possible conflicts that can come from an immediate family member. Such as including the family member's employer to a list of recipients of a potential benefit or harm from the passage of legislation. And lastly, HB 44 adds language that would ensure that every legislator is able to vote on the final operating budget. Again, AS 3707020A and AS 3707100, the Executive Budget Act. That concludes that section, if there was questions on any of that.
Yeah. Representative Birch, did I see a hand earlier for a question?
Yeah, I guess there's so many hypotheticals here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It'd be helpful to, we just finished, doing our financial disclosure. As a matter of fact, I just got out of a committee where we were talking about, charging everybody $50 to submit your financial disclosure on an annual basis. So the public has access online to financial disclosure for every seated member of the legislature. Over the past year, you can look, for the most part, you can look and you can see how many bills are submitted by, 120, I forget what we're up to now, but, bills and legislation that would potentially impact every legislator. So I guess given the visibility and the exposure that everybody has, the hypothetical conflicts, I guess I'm curious as to whether in the past there are any, Mr. Anderson perhaps might identify anything that he would perceive as a real conflict that would be characterized by any of the information that we have, looking back, real data, not hypothetical data. I kind of struggle with that. Like I say, we're kind of mushing around, working this around the edges, and it seems to me like it's just going to be a huge tangle trying to figure out, what's substantial and what's not substantial, and one person's judgment against another person's judgment, as opposed to just putting all the information out on the table. And maybe the sponsor could speak to that, right?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, if I guess I missed the question.
The question is, are you aware of an instance that this legislation would remedy over the past year, 2 years, 5 years? I mean, is this going to add value or do something constructive by way of, illustrating a conflict that may not otherwise have existed or been, the public may have been aware of with the rather detailed financial disclosure that we have already and clearly the public process that we go through?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I would say that this would not remedy someone from declaring, but because how we currently have it is one person unanimously can have you be forced to vote, and that's not on the public record. We don't know the details of that conflict of interest that person had, or why they stood to ask to abstain. This proposed legislation would allow them to speak to that for the benefit of the rest of the body to then vote on that, and then that vote would be public record. And so if people felt that there was a publicness to a conflict that you might have had because they looked at some of your records, this then puts it on the record to how the rest of the body felt about that conflict. And so if a member of the public felt you had a conflict, and you could say, look, I spoke to that conflict, my legislative body said, no, I did not have a conflict, And now that's public record, and I can be public with that information. So it's just about adding transparency, matching, trying to be consistent with our own statutes of what we ask municipalities to do, and also matching what 49 other states do, how they handle legislative ethics.
By the way, a follow up. I mean, if the objective here is to, you know, get our work done in a timely way, I just don't see where this is going to do anything to diminish the amount of time, or in fact improve the public view and perception of the work we do here, given the amount of disclosure that we're already required to do, at least from my perspective. Thank you.
Through the chair, I would state through our research, we were showing some examples here of citizen legislatures, where Wyoming, you can see, has a citizen legislature, a very, very low salary. They all have other employers, other jobs. In the past several years, I believe in the past 3 years, they've had only 10 instances where this has come up. And so it's a very, very low, and they put out a lot more bills than we do, actually. We have, when we can share those numbers with you. It's a very low number. It's not every bill someone's standing and going through a conflict and needing resolution. We were actually surprised by how low that number is. But again, it's about, for us, this is about transparency and building trust, and anything we can do that adds to the public records of our interests, we believe that's a good thing for governance.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a couple of questions or thoughts. I mean, I have a lot of experience with this in municipal government. I've been through it many, 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 many times. I've seen it at its very worst. But anyway, first question is, in your language, you have domestic partner. Do we have that in our statute? I mean, do we have that definition there? Is that, I mean, I don't need to see the definition. I just want to make sure it's already in codes or statute somewhere.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, Ryan Johnson, staff representative Grant, it currently is in statute in AS 2460-990. The definition section for it is in there as well.
Okay. And then the next follow-up.
Oh, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The $10,000 per year limit less than $2,000 a month? Less than $1,000 a month impact per family member? Just out of curiosity, where did you come up with that number? It seems very, very low.
Ryan Johnson, staff representative Gren, through the chair, Representative Johnson, $10,000 is actually relatively high compared to some other states. Some other states have it as low as $500 from an employer, and we got the $10,000 directly from our statute in what is required of a person of the public when defining a substantial interest. And in our language, it's for the preceding 12-month period. So it could be you had a job for 3 months and got $15,000 from that job, and then were elected into the legislature. We tried to set a benchmark that would ensure that within that preceding year, you would catch a potential employer that a conflict could arise from.
Follow up?
My other concern is the desire to block minority members' votes, and I've actually seen that in action. And I was just wondering if you would speak to your research on that event.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I've called several states. I talked with Wyoming. I talked to New Mexico and Montana. I'm trying to talk to similar states and states that also used a majority consent from the body. And they said they hadn't seen a case of that. And the way we look at it is it's public record. And it's a double-edged sword for a majority because the minority can say, hey, look, this is what they're doing to us. They're barring us when we don't have or when we raise to a conflict, and they're doing it just out of a political way to use it. And in our thought process as well, we did see, like Wyoming, you can see, is a majority consent of the Rules Committee required to abstain. And we saw that, but we thought that's even more partisan than leaving it to a floor vote. So, again, we looked at what is in our current statute, and that's where the majority vote comes from. And the majority of states that do use a vote to abstain or not abstain used a majority vote, so that's we use that as well.
And in light of time, and I know there are two other questions from the committee, I'm going to sort of pause on this thread, although it seems really productive, and allow Representative Tuck and Representative Knopp final question.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a statement and just want to point out, I know we haven't had a lot of bills on the floor yet, nor this year have we had anyone have to declare a conflict of interest. But what this bill does do is it prevents people from having to make that declaration on the operating budget, because that's where you see it all happening. So this actually streamlines it, makes it less the need to be able to do it, not more the need. And the second thing is it is a disservice when someone can't even finish declaring a conflict and someone objects, interrupts and objects. And so I think we're doing the public a big disservice when we do that.
And last question or comment for this particular hearing, Representative Knopp.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gran, Representative Gran. So, you know, there are some portions of what we do on the floor in objection to a conflict that I don't agree with. So I can tell you that in municipal government, when a conflict is declared, the chair makes that decision, and then the body has the right to object to that decision and vote on overruling the chair. And that seems to be a method that works very, very well in local government. So I would support that if that's the way we were going. But the declarations of conflicts are so numerous, and we don't necessarily function well on the floor a lot of the times, and I hate to put more cumbersome stuff on there, and it seems like we have a need to over-declare. We seem to declare everything for the sake of making sure that we're covering our bases, so to speak. So I would support that other change, but I think when we start talking about immediate family members, potential conflicts, I think that's where I'm struggling with this here. So for the record, thank you.
And any closing comment, Representative Grenner, Mr. Johnson, before we gavel out for this particular hearing?
Through the chair, again, thank you for this time for us to present. The rest of the presentation, we just did examples of citizen legislatures. You know, we were trying to put us on the same level as other states. And so, you know, these are just other examples. And I think, you know, for us, this is just another way that we can work with the public and show the public during times when we're asking them to trust us, and, you know, during the biggest votes we might be taking in our political lives, that, you know, that we, when we have conflicts or even potential conflicts, that we're trying to avoid any perception that, you know, that something that's happening in Juneau is hidden or not public record. So we can share this presentation with the committee. They'd like to go through it on their own. But I think at this time, we're good for now.
Mr. Chairman. With apologies to the chicken farmers, please.
Apologies to chicken farmers, tank drivers, and anyone else we might have forgotten. Point well taken. And I collective, a lot of hypotheticals out there to consider. At this time, we're going to adjourn at 4:26. Finance Subcommittee starts in 4 minutes, theoretically, and we have a hearing again at 5:30 to resume this piece of legislation.
Testifier mic 1-2, testing testifier mic 1-2. Testing committee mic, testing 1-2. Testing mic 1-2-3-4-5-6. Testing 1-2. Chair mic testing 1-2. Testing co-chair mic testing 1-2. Testing, testing, 1, 2. Testing, mic, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Sounds good. All right. State Affairs coming to order at 5:35 p.m. For our Encore Tuesday meeting. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Tuff? Representative Josephson? Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wohl?
Here.
Representative Kopp? Representative Ledoux? Representative Birch?
Here.
Chair of Christ Tompkins?
Here. And with five members present, we have a quorum to do business. We're finishing up with House Bill 44 and HCR 1 per earlier today. I think the goal today is to finish the presentation and exhaust any outstanding committee member questions. A couple of notes. Representative Tuck is not able to make it because of a finance subcommittee conflict, and Representative Ledoux also similarly conflicted. And per the meeting earlier today, the Select Committee on Ethics, through Representative Tuck, has been able to provide some advisory opinions, which are being provided in hard copy and I think will soon be converted into digital. So that should be on basis and for members and the public's reference. And in addition, we have hard copies of the presentation today from Representative Gren's office, and those are available to the members and presumably will also be available in digital form as well. Representative Gren and Mr. Johnson, would you please feel free to finish your presentation, and we'll take questions from there.
Sure. For the record, Representative Jason Gren, proudly representing District 22 in Anchorage, Alaska.
For the record, Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Jason Gren. So I'm going to continue on with...
Yeah, please, Mr. Johnson.
So continuing on, again, as Representative Gren stated before, we wanted to include some examples of citizen legislatures because Alaska is a citizen legislature. So New Mexico and Wyoming are two examples. Due to the similar size, they are larger in body than Alaska, but similar in size as well as population. And again, just pointing out that New Mexico uses the majority consent of the body to require for an abstention, and they use the general public language when determining a conflict. And then Wyoming, they actually do the majority consent of the Rules Committee required to abstain, and then Wyoming uses the use of the substantial class language. So two examples, and then just two more examples. Again, South Dakota and Idaho, you can see from the slide, South Dakota uses the majority consent of the body, and they use different language than the substantial class or general public. And then Idaho, so Idaho is an example where a state has two separate rules for the Senate and the House. The Senate in Idaho uses a two-thirds consent, and in the House, they just abstain by declaring a conflict on the floor, and then they're immediately allowed to abstain. So I have also included for you a flowchart, which includes the current procedure, and then on the next slide, we'll have the procedure under HB 44 and HCR1. So if you'd like to follow along, I know you have it in hard copy now as well. It's towards the end of your packet. So under the current procedure, a legislator believes they have a conflict of interest under AS 2460-030. The legislator stands on the floor, declares their conflict, and requests to abstain. A unanimous consent is needed to allow for the legislator to abstain. So there is an objection. The legislator abstains and does not, or there is not an objection, and the legislator does abstain and does not vote, which, for note, has never happened in the history of our legislature. since the enactment of this rule. And then there is an objection raised, and the legislator does is required to vote, and that objection made on the floor is not required or is not recorded in the journal. And Representative Tuck brought up earlier, and a point we would like to make is that there's no record made of the actual conflict from the representative who is declaring a conflict. What's reflected in the journal is X representative stood, declared a conflict, there was an objection, they were required to vote. So that is all that is recorded in the journal as of now. The procedure under or implemented by HB 44 and HGR 1 is noted here. Again, a legislator believes they have a conflict under AS 2460-030. Again, with the amending done in HB 44, it then adds in the employer, immediate family members, and then the immediate family member's employer as well. The legislator stands on the floor, declares a conflict. They explain their conflict and then ask to abstain. Then at that point, a majority consent is required to allow for the abstention. If there is a majority consent, the legislator is allowed to abstain and does not vote. The vote representing the allowing of the abstention is recorded in the journal. And if there is not a majority consent, the legislator must vote, and then that vote is recorded into the journal of that day. And then thank you for your consideration. So we'll take questions at this point.
Representative Ledoux.
So just sort of wondering why it is that a majority must if the majority, getting this confused. So the majority consents and then the legislator doesn't have to vote or does have to vote?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it is if there is a consent, it is allowing the abstention, so the legislator does not vote.
So that would be a majority.
Correct. If there was a majority vote was cast to allow for the abstention, the legislator would not have to vote.
Okay. So is that the way it is done in other legislatures that provide for a majority, because you could theoretically do it on the flip side of things too? And I was also wondering how it might have been done in the municipal assembly or any assemblies around the state.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in what we have seen from other states, it's that same kind of method. A legislator must ask to is making a motion to abstain. There is not a majority vote to disqualify them from voting. And then, actually, the municipality, for Anchorage, or for Alaska, I do have the statute for that, and it actually goes to a different process where the assembly member asks the presiding officer if they can abstain, and then, depending on the decision of the presiding officer, the body can then vote to override that the chair's decision.
So if the presiding officer says yes, it would take yes, you can abstain, then it would take a majority to require that person to vote and vice versa.
Through the chair, Representative, from my understanding, that is correct, but Representative Knopp might be able to answer this question better than or Representative Johnson.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ledoux, that's exactly how it works. What happens in an assembly meeting, assembly member will declare a conflict. The residing officer, president of the assembly, will make that determination if the conflict truly exists. At that point, any member of the body can object to the presiding officer's opinion and ask for a vote of the body to overrule the officer's determination. So if the officer is overruled so hypothetically, if the officer ruled that the member had a conflict, member objected, it would go to a full vote of the body, excluding the member who declared the conflict. And then if the majority voted to override the assembly president, then that member would be required to participate and vote. If they upheld his opinion, then that assembly member would abstain from voting on the issue.
Thank you. And in the spirit of former Representative Grunberg, could I dialogue for a moment with Representative Knopp?
Please, Representative Knopp and Representative Liu, feel free to dialogue.
We've heard Representative Johnson state that in her assembly, it sounds like the system was gamed, depending upon what side of an issue people were on. How'd you feel that it worked out where you were?
You know, in our assembly, local municipal government, there was no partisanship whatsoever. We've never had that as an issue. I did raise that with Representative Grin. I don't know if it would be an issue here or not. I think people would really vote on the validity of the issue. That's how I personally think, feel people are ethical enough. They would vote on the issue, not on partisan. So it has never been an issue for us. It's always worked extremely well. I think it's very rarely that we ever had an occasion where members disagreed with the presiding president's opinion on that conflict. So
you've never had an occasion where the presiding member was overruled?
Yes, we have, but it was very rarely.
Oh,
very
okay.
Rarely.
Thank you.
Very rarely.
And we have a wealth of municipal perspectives on this committee, fortunately, Representative Birch, Representative Johnson. I have a question for the sponsor. In one of the slides about halfway through the presentation, I didn't see slide numbers, so I can't cite the exact one. I think it was speaking to how other states grapple with the sort of substantial class definition, that slide. I wanted to ask, that didn't add up to 50 states, so I was wondering what the gap between these 29 states and 50 states, what the other 21 states not included in this breakdown do.
Mr. Chair, yeah, it's you're right, it doesn't add up to 50. The remaining states kind of have a hodgepodge of stealing different language from different states and how they, you know, make it their own. We determined that these states in our calculation were very foundational in their language to say they were a substantial class language state, or the effect on general public is the language they used. The others are, I think, a little tougher to determine. You know, if it pleases the committee, we definitely can show the other states or put a breakdown. I mean, they might even be actually in our packets. I think we have a breakdown of all 50 states in here of their language, and so you can peruse and see what each state uses. But this calculation was based on what we thought we could tally up and feel very confident in where they landed.
And then the other question I wanted to ask is similar to what Representative Ledoux was asking of Representative Johnson's and Representative Knopf's experience, which is when you spoke with people in other states, I thought I heard you say earlier that no one really referenced or was familiar with the sort of gamesmanship approach to these majority consent votes. And I have to admit, and as you know from the previous committee, I'm actually, you know, really sympathetic to that concern. And I'd want to make sure we're protected against it. And could you maybe speak to which states you spoke with people in as to sort of probing that concern?
Ryan Johnston, staff representative Grin. Mr. Chair, so in speaking with Wyoming, I bridged that concern to them as of gamesmanship, and they said they had never had received or seen a case like that where someone had used the system in a way to stop someone from voting. I also spoke to someone in New Mexico, because New Mexico is a prime example of a citizen legislature. They receive no salary and only receive $163 a day for this session. So they clearly have people that are working in industries and have conflicts and are employed outside of the legislature. And when talking to there, I spoke to the chief clerk there, and I spoke also to the rules chair, someone in their office, and they said the same thing, that they had never really seen a situation where someone had used this as a mechanism to against another legislator. It was kind of in the spirit of what Representative Knopf was talking about, is that people take this seriously and try and use an objective view when they look at this and make a a decision on the facts presented.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my only thought was the way that it's written is two-thirds majority on the vote. Is that correct? Two-thirds?
Just a majority, not a two-thirds majority, just a majority of the body. The language in HB or HCR 1 is a majority vote of the body.
And not to hurry you, just make sure to identify yourself in there, because I suspect your voices sound somewhat similar throughout the tape. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. So I guess I was just wondering if you know, it might be potential to make it a two-third majority or a three-quarter majority, so you don't, you know, you're not going to end up with a, I mean, you know, it's a little more of a stringent requirement, I guess.
And through the chair, Representative Johnson, obviously there's states that have a two-thirds majority, and through our research, you know, we found what the breakdown is. And even though a majority of them use a majority vote, the main basis of where we came and why we landed on that was to be consistent with what we're asking municipalities to do. Again, ours is a larger body than what municipalities in terms of membership. But, you know, we're here to discuss amendments in offices and go through potential changes. And so we're willing to discuss reasons for changes. So we'd be happy to talk.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few points, so please bear with me. On the very last thing you just said about municipalities and trying to be like them, but as Representative Knopp pointed out, at least his municipality is nonpartisan. People don't have D's and R's after their name. They're probably a smaller body. I assume a borough assembly is 7, 9, 11, something like that, not 40. And I'm not that experienced being in this legislature, but there are a lot of votes that are very partisan and party line, and so that suggestion maybe is not a bad one to try to break away beyond just necessarily parties. So a few questions, and I'll start from the beginning where I started notes the other day. So Representative Birch asks, is there any particular case you can think of that this is trying to remedy? In other words, was there something that came up in recent history that you can recall that this bill would try to solve? And as I recall, you didn't really have a particular case, but you said transparency and public trust. Was that kind of it, sort of get the public more confident in our transparency?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, you're correct. This the desire to put forward this legislation was not based on any previous actions, any previous legislation.
Well, I just, if I may, through the chair, I can think of a couple examples in my observation where the public has maybe lost some confidence and trust, and I'm not picking on any one industry or any individuals in any one industry, but I will use the oil industry as an example, where if an individual works in the oil industry and then votes on a certain a bill that affects that industry, there's a lot of people that have some problems with that. But this bill wouldn't address that at all. If I'm an oil exec and a legislator, or executive, if I'm an employee of an oil company and a legislator and I vote on an oil tax bill, this bill will not touch me. Is that correct?
Brian Johnston, staff representative Graham, through the chair, Representative Wool, under the current statute, there is no provision for an employer-employee relationship. It's only about negotiating employment. But with the new legislation, in our opinion, it does open the avenue for a potential employer, because it does include about an employer. But it would just have to fall under that standard if the substantial class language is met. So if Representative Klayman in Judiciary used the example of if he worked as an ARCO, like he represented ARCO, and if there was a oil legislation that came about that specifically affected ARCO benefit or harm more than the rest of the oil industry, then yet we would say that he does have a conflict of interest there and he would need to declare it. So these are very, I know you're not going to like the answer, but it's very fact-driven situations that need to be taken into account. So it's, I would not say no, that this legislation would not do that to any executive at any business, not just the oil industry, but it would be, it does open the door now, but under current law, I would say no, it does not.
I'm more interested in your bill, not in current law. So if I'm an oil employee, I work for an oil company, and I work on a bill that affects oil taxes, which is not any particular oil company, but the whole class of oil companies. And I don't declare a conflict of interest, and or I do, but this bill, because I'm just a regular employee voting on a bill that affects an industry, this bill would not affect my voting or not voting.
And maybe just a point, and this sort of coming out of the previous committee, I wonder, even though we're going all over the place with our hypotheticals, if maybe
this is actually something that happens. Yeah, it's not chicken farming. It's bills, oil taxes, and oil employees.
And that's actually the point I'm about to make, which is maybe just sort of maintain a circumspection about how pointed the hypotheticals get.
Yeah, and I don't mean to point out anyone in particular. And so I could use chicken farming, but that's a little obtuse, I guess. But anyhow, and I'm not trying to – you can
Mr.
answer
Johnson,
it or not, and I'll go on.
Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Graham. Through the chair to Representative Wool, I think this bill does – there are situations where an executive from any business would have to question, and because it then goes to a vote of the body, that legislator then can stand and make the case for either, hey, I fall under this conflict, but, you know, I think I have an objective view and I can vote my conscience on this. And then it goes, or they can say, hey, I have a substantial conflict. I would like to be excused from this vote. And then it goes to a vote of the body. And so it's really focused on, HDR1 is really focused on putting things on the record from that vote, because then it shows that you requested to abstain, and then either the body, a majority of the body agreed with you and you were allowed to abstain, or they said, you know, your conflict isn't substantial and you can vote. And then from the employer side of it, again, this legislation is adding in an employer, because previous statute does not have that. So this is really focused on, I think, in adding in that situation you're talking about with an employee-employer relationship.
Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. Well, you said something that I'm not sure you realized, but you said I could stand up and say, hey, I can vote on this, but that's not what this is about. This is standing up to abstain and then having a vote about abstaining. This isn't standing up to say, hey, I work for this company, but I'm still going to vote. That's a totally different issue. If I felt I could vote, I wouldn't stand up to abstain. That's my understanding of it. So there is a discussion. If I say, hey, I have a conflict of interest, I don't want to vote, and then there's a vote on the floor, then there's a dialogue, a discussion, right? There's some sort of disclosure of more detail?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, it's a non-debatable motion. So after, if a legislator was to stand, they made their peace and spoke to their conflict, it would immediately be taken up as a vote. There would be no debate on the motion.
Okay. Follow up? Yeah. Now, you made mention in one of your flowcharts that as it currently states, I claim a conflict of interest. Someone just blurts out, I object, and then I'm told to vote. What if that was more formal? What if the person stood up, had to be on record and say, I, so-and-so, object to that person abstaining? Would that be better? Would that sort of make this any better? Would that be enough?
You know, we're speaking to what the bill is proposing, and focus on what we believe are beneficial changes. I mean, there's maybe more hypotheticals regarding what might be better, but you know, we're focusing on what we're proposing.
Okay, and my last comment, I guess I'm just trying to figure out, again, back to Representative Birch's question, and I'm not that experienced. I haven't been around here that long, and you guys have probably been around here less. But based on my limited, I'm just what situation are we? Is it really? And I guess there's an example of a case in front of us, so I can read that. I'm just trying to play it out in my mind how it's going to work and if it's going to be overly cumbersome with a lot of. So, anyhow, I'm done.
Thanks, Representative Wolt. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not a question, just a brief comment. So I want to reply to Representative Wolt. If an individual stood up and objected, you'd want to give reason why you objected. And so it has probably the same merit as a speaker standing up or saying, I would support your conflict or not. So you probably wouldn't want to get into that debate on the floor with 40 members. You know, everybody would have a different opinion on that. So my comment for the Representative Gren, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. And the bill's got a lot of support in the public because there are perceived conflicts. But I think for the most part, they are perceived. We historically don't have the issue of conflicts. And I think members are generally good about declaring what they think is a conflict. I think that's always a debatable issue. And so I want you to know that I like the attempt, and I agree with you. I don't like the process we have on the floor about the objection. I'd rather see the chair make the decision and then the body decide to object to his decision or not, you know. If that was what was in front of us, I'd be behind you 100%. But what I can't support, I think, is all the proposed changes in the declaration of conflicts. I think that's my problem when we start getting down into family members and employment. I mean, I think that we are so cautious right now about declaring everything that we just get to be so cumbersome and inefficient on the floor, and that is my big concern. If we'd had a history of really of a lot of potential conflicts and abuse, and I'd be behind it, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So I'm not really sure what we're trying to fix other than the one issue about our process currently on the floor. So I just wanted to make that for the record. Thank you.
Further questions or comments from the committee? Representative Johnson.
I want to commend the bill sponsor for just, I think it's a really honest attempt to, and I mean, you know, maybe more than an attempt to work on something that I think the public really, you know, wants to see or to have some maybe additional reassurance on. And so anyway, I just appreciate you bringing it forward. Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
I appreciate your bringing it forward, and I wholeheartedly support it.
And before this sounds like too funereal or as though we're reaching the end of the tunnel, I should note, and I think for members' information as well as the sponsor, we'll hold this probably for a solid week, both to allow the sponsor to have conversations or any of you who are interested in tweaking components of the bill through amendments or whatever it might be, and we'll revisit it at that point in time. So lots of time to sort of sit, contemplate, work it over. And have conversations. So hopefully that allows the process to work well. And on that note, given that I know there are a panoply of receptions tonight in Juneau and personal lives to live and all of that, barring further questions or comments from the committee, adjourn this meeting at 6:03 p.m. and thank everyone for being here.